Let's continue our investigation here, examination of the differences that Buddha introduced into Hindu doctrine, and why it became a separate religion. And I mentioned some of them. He dismissed the caste system entirely. That's just part of illusion. And the world really is an illusion. And so is everything about it. Buddhists think that if you press scientific investigation, you will ultimately come to absurdities and contradictions and things that not only have no explanation but seem crazy. And that's just part of the way nature evinces itself to be illusory. He also rejected the idea that karma is an inviolable iron law that can't be bent or escaped at all. Karma is the force that's the name for the fact that when you are reborn, you are reborn in a way that punishes you for your evil in the previous life or rewards you for the good of your previous life. So it's tied with the idea of samsara. And karma has there's no escaping it in Hinduism. Buddha taught that there is a karma for people who do evil, but for people who do good, who are seeking enlightenment, they can escape this. He called them arahats. The arahat who by steadfast mind has come to exempt himself from evil desire may feel assured that the old karma is exhausted and no new karma is being produced. These are the wise who will be extinguished at death like a lamp. There will be no rebirth for them. It is only those who are not emancipated from the will to live and have the desire who will be reborn. So there is a way to get out of the clutches of karma. And there's a freedom that an individual has. The individual determines to follow the proper path and divest himself of desire and meditate and achieve nirvana, then he can escape the karma altogether. And so this is part of Buddha's reason for rejecting the caste. It doesn't matter what caste I've been born into. I can achieve nirvana directly from any caste. I don't have to be reborn a Brahmin to do it. And I don't have to be reborn a man to do it. He dismissed the difference between the sexes as well. Women can do it. In fact, Buddha said, at times, someone who isn't even seeking nirvana, who is not engaged in the discipline, can become suddenly enlightened like a lightning bolt and be emancipated from desire and achieve nirvana. And that lightning bolt of emancipation and knowledge he called Zen. Well, all of this is too much for the Hindus. And they were very resistant to Buddha's teaching. He's dismissing karma. He's dismissing samsara and karma as inevitable. He's dismissing the castes. The whole idea of how to achieve proper relation to the divine, it's the same divine, but it's a totally different idea of how to achieve proper relation to it. And some people have compared Buddha to Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. They think there's a similarity between the way Buddha reformed Hinduism and the way Luther reformed Christianity. I think that's largely a misleading comparison. And let me tell you why. Both Luther and the established church of the Middle Ages were acknowledging the authority of the scriptures, of what had been first the Hebrew, the Jewish scriptures, and then the addition of the New Testament. And they were engaged in interpreting those. So they both had a common authority. And Luther was not trying to start a new religion. What he wanted to do was go back to his impression of what the New Testament saw as the proper Christian life and the proper role of the church and so on. And the established church disagreed with him, of course. But it was not a whole new way of achieving proper relation to God. It was taken from writings that had pre-existed both Luther and the medieval church. In Buddha's case, it's his own private personal insight into how to think of the proper relation to God or to the divine, Brahmanatman or the nothingness. And without a common authoritative source to appeal to. So there's a very large difference in the way the two operated, though I can see why people would be tempted to make that comparison. It's not nearly as far-reaching a change as what Buddha inaugurated. Now we come to another point of great difference that just caused a lot of consternation as well. No soul or self in Buddhism. There's nothing that passes over from one life to the next. Well, then it doesn't seem as though anything is being reborn. You're not being reincarnated. Something brand new is taking the place of the one who died. But Buddha said that he neither affirmed nor denied that something passes over. But then that nothing passes over seems to come to be prevalent, to prevail. So among all the things that he said he didn't say, remember we read that last time, I didn't say this, I didn't say the world's finite or infinite, I didn't say this or that or the other thing. He says, what I want to talk about is the origin of misery and how to escape it. The path leading to the cessation of misery, that's what I talk about. And why? Because this does people good. It profits them to know it. And it has to do with the fundamentals of religion and tends to absence of passion, leads us to knowledge, supreme wisdom, and nirvana. That's what's important. There's a story that some people asked Buddha one day about the creation of the universe. Well, granted that this world is Maya, but how does it get here? Why does it exist? And in Hinduism, there is a creation story. Brahmanatman generates the world of Maya, and every so many hundred million years, it destroys that one and makes a new one. That's in Hinduism. But Buddha just stood there and wouldn't answer. And the teaching is, that's conveyed, is it's not helpful to think about that. You shouldn't be paying that much attention to the world of Maya in the first place to wonder how it got here or why it exists. Just try to escape it. Divest yourself of any interest at all. And the same then goes, however, for the individual human soul. That's part of the Maya world. And this was a debate carried on after Buddha's death. There were meetings of Buddhists, they debated this issue, and one said that the unreality of the self was total. There is no self at all. That's just part of of illusion. And the other side said, well, the self isn't the substantial thing people tend to think it is, but there has to be some self even to raise the question and even to deny the existence of the self. And they went back and forth about that for several centuries. I read one of those debates that took place in China in the 7th century. It's fascinating to see these people argue in that way. But if there's a real problem here, and it is, if nothing passes over, then it can't be said to be reincarnated or reborn. It would be something brand new. Let me see if I can try to make that clear. It's an issue that is raised in philosophy. It has to do with what's called the identity of indiscernibles. If we are in doubt as to whether we're dealing with only one thing or with two things, then if it turns out that everything that's true about one is true about the other, there's really only one. So I may have two names, but they're for the same thing. It's like Clark Kent and Superman. If they're really one person, identical person, then anything that's true of Clark Kent is also true of Superman, and vice versa. It can't be that they have one has a property the other doesn't have. If one thing has any characteristic the other lacks, then there are two things and not one. Take another example. We use the expression morning star. And we use the expression evening star. And those two expressions don't mean the same thing, but they both refer to Venus. Venus as it appears in the morning was called the morning star. Venus as it appears in the evening was called the evening star. But there was really only one thing there. And everything that was true of this was true of this, and vice versa, because it was the same object. Now, if you have one soul, one being, who dies here, and if that really is to cease existing, then when a new soul or a new self takes over, in reincarnation, they can't be the same thing because this one lacks a property this one has. Namely, this one ceased to exist at a certain time. This one didn't do that. And this one began to exist at a certain time, and this one didn't do that. So each one has a property the other doesn't have, and there are two things and not one. Nevertheless, that's what Buddha asserted. There is reincarnation, but there is no soul that passes over from one to the other. And I don't think that makes any sense. And here's why. But that sort of ruins the whole idea of reincarnation or karma at all. Granted, he wanted to loosen up those ideas and make karma and samsara escapable and more quickly and easily than in Hinduism. Nevertheless, he still believed in them. He still believed that if you were evil in this life, you'd be punished for it in the next. How can you when it's not you being punished in the next? If it isn't you who continues to exist and gets reborn, then who's being punished for the evil you did in this life? And yet that goes on being the explanation when evil things befall us in this life. That's called, in Christian context, the problem of evil. It doesn't mean why do people do moral evil? It means why do bad things befall people who don't seem to deserve them? It's about undeserved pain, undeserved suffering. Why is there undeserved suffering in the world? And the Hindu and Buddhist answer is because people have done evil in a previous life, they suffer in this life. So it looks as though they don't deserve it, but they do because of what they did in the previous life. That's the Hindu and Buddhist answer. And it continues to be Buddha's answer, even though I think by denying that there is a self and a soul and denying that it is reborn and passes over in reincarnation, he's undermined that doctrine. That is an inconsistent set of teachings. That doesn't bother a Buddhist because he doesn't think consistency is a mark of anything. The entire illusory world's inconsistent in his view, so he doesn't care about that. A Jew or Christian or Muslim would have to give a different answer. We don't believe that we've lived a previous life and are being punished for things in it. Why do undeserved sufferings befall good people is the subject of the book of Job. And the Judeo-Christian Muslim answer to that is very different. And we'll get to that. We'll cover that when we get there. So the what all this boils down to is avoid attachment. That's the way, that's the wisdom that leads to enlightenment, which leads to nirvana. And nirvana is an escape from pain and woe and suffering. And it is the only escape. So avoid every attachment whatsoever. Now that brings me back to a point that I raised about Buddha's experience of enlightenment. He's there with his five friends, and they realize just by the look on his face that he's achieved enlightenment, and that he could at that point achieve nirvana. I mean, to their view, it would look like he died, but in fact he would have achieved nirvana. But he stays in the world of illusion in order to preach this good news of enlightenment to them and to others. And that's supposed to be love without attachment. So it's the only the only sense of love that's allowed. It's this Buddha sense, the sense where you do something charitable and that's beneficial to somebody else without becoming attached to them. If you become attached, then you've destroyed the enlightenment. So family attachments have to be severed. Attachments to things, to possessions, to wealth, even being attached to preserving your own body. He does not prescribe the extreme asceticism that he found didn't work, but neither are you to prefer care of your body to in such a way that it becomes an attachment for you. So there are 10 pitfalls to this attempt to divest yourself of attachment. And the 10 pitfalls are, number one, the belief in the existence of a self and soul. He believes that is the first thing that undermines your attempt to divest yourself of all attachment. And second, doubt. Doubt. It's very interesting that he lists that. You're to accept this stuff on trust that it is true, that he is reporting to you his experience as he has had it, and it can be a guide to yours. Three, he lists trust in rituals for salvation. If you think that by worshiping gods, by being pious, giving to the poor, attending the various services, observing holy days and so on, is going to help you at all, that's just another chain holding you back, preserving attachments that you should be free of. Four, lust. And here he's talking about sexual desire as another thing that you have to divest yourself from. Five, anger and resentment. Six, the very desire to be reborn into other worlds, into a better life. Desire to be reborn up the scale of reincarnation is itself an attachment you should divest yourself from. What you really want is to be unattached to it all and escape it all at once, not work yourself up your way up the chain, you know, from woman to untouchable and untouchable to low class to middle class and so on until you become a Brahmin. And I forget now, I was going to say that how many castes there are, you know, in India. There are so many castes and subcastes that it turns out that be an incredible number. Another thing that prevents people from divesting themselves of all desire is pride. And then the ninth is self-righteousness, wanting to make yourself look right and good. And the last is ignorance. Now, there are two main branches of Buddhism today. One is called Theravada, and the other is called Mahayana. And the Theravada Buddhism is the smaller group. Most Buddhists are Mahayana. But in the Theravada tradition, anyone who accomplishes the first three of these divests himself of belief in the self, divests himself of doubt, and divests himself of trust in any rituals for salvation, that monk cannot be reborn more than seven times. And when he conquers four and five, he can only be reborn once more before entering nirvana. And when he conquers all ten, he will attain the earthly experience of nirvana and become an arahat. He will experience nirvana in his meditative trance. The Theravada Buddhism is closer to the original, as far as we can tell. The Mahayana has more developments and changes in that. But we'll come to that on another occasion, explain more about that. I wanted to read to you another section from the Buddhist scriptures. But the men of your country are violent, cruel, and savage. When they become angry at you and do you harm, what do you think? I think them truly good and kind folk. For while they speak angry and insulting words, they didn't strike or stone me. They are very violent folk. What if they do strike and stone you? Then I'll think them kind and good not to have killed me with a sword. And what if they do kill you? Then I'll think them kind and good indeed who freed me from this vile body with so little pain. Well said, well said. Your great gift of patience, you may indeed try this task. Go yourself. You are saved. Now save others. So it's the divesting of any desire, no matter what anybody else does, that is going to lead to this, to the enlightenment and to nirvana. And notice that Buddha's idea of nirvana is very much like the original Hinduism. It just means being annihilated and freed from all pain and suffering. It is nothing like being in the presence of a god and living a life of pleasure and happiness, which came into Hinduism toward the end under Christian influence. Now, I mentioned the difference between Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism, and I need to explain a little more about that. In the Mahayana tradition, there arose a teaching about people who achieve nirvana, the Buddha called an arahat, and they were called bodhisattvas in Mahayana Buddhism. And it was speculated that a person who achieves nirvana then proceeds to be absorbed in the nirvana in stages. It's gradual, it takes a while. And in the interim, between the time they die and the time that they're completely achieved absorption into nirvana, they may be able to help you in some way. And so they get treated somewhat like the way in which Roman Catholics think of saints, as people who have died and are in the presence of God and can help you. If you pray to them, they can aid you in some way. And Mahayana Buddhism, they're, by doing that, introduced something new in between stages. And whereas Buddha himself said nobody else can help you, even if there are gods, they can't help you. It's up to you to save yourself. Now we get this modification. And there are many other modifications that go so far as pure land Buddhism, which is very popular in Japan, which shows again a heavy Christian influence. And the idea there is that if one achieves divesting oneself of all desire and achieves nirvana, what happens is that one goes to the pure land, which is the land with all the other people who have achieved this, and it is a conscious individual life that's happy. And only then, from there, they can achieve absorption into unconsciousness if they wish. It's striking how both these traditions are impacted by the Christian idea of everlasting life in the presence of God, the restitution of you as an individual bodily life, and enjoyment forever. That's a powerful idea that has infected both of these religions. It's actually inconsistent with their basis, but which they cannot seem to resist. Of course, the Theravada Buddhists would resist it and say that's why they're not the real thing, but they're very interesting people. I had the pleasure of being at the main temple, the big Buddhist temple in Bangkok, on Buddha's birthday, and they had quite a celebration and a procession of people putting gold onto the dome and so on. And the monks were all out chanting, and it was very impressive. I remember writing home to my father and said, today we were at Wat Po, and they celebrated Buddha's life, birth, and death, but not resurrection, which is the main difference. If you've traveled at all, you will be keenly aware that there are more statues of Buddha on this planet, by far, than any other person who ever lived. And his teaching is respected greatly by people who don't practice it. In countries that are Buddhist, a monk is revered. Some years ago there was a riot in downtown Bangkok, and it was broken up, not by the police, but because somebody put a monk on the hood of a car and drove into the middle of the crowd, and the crowd parted. And nobody would think of harming or threatening a monk. People who don't practice divesting all desire nevertheless revere people who are trying to do that. And that's the state of affairs in a country that's largely Buddhist. The only country that is solidly Theravada Buddhist is Thailand, and the country that used to be called Madagascar. I don't remember the new name of it now. But we'll wrap this up, and next time we'll begin with Judaism. So be sure again to do the readings, then see the lecture, then do the readings again.